It seems you may have acquired wisdom enough, and in time. In time to be dead, I said. But, yeah, I worked out by now that the Shi don't give anything away, or take anything for free, and after however long, I realized why that might be. Because you can't.
Indeed, she said, beaming at me. There must be balance, sweet godchild. Always balance. Never take a thing without giving such a thing in return. Never give a favor without collecting one in kind. All of reality depends on balance. I squinted at her. That's why you gave Bianca Amorakius years ago. So that you could accept that knife from her, the one Mab took from you.
She leaned toward me, her eyes all but glowing with intensity, and her teeth showing in a sudden carnivorous smile.
Indeed. And such a treacherous gift it was, child. Oh, but if that deceitful creature had survived you, such a vengeance I would have wreaked that the world would have spoken of it in whispers for 1,000 years. I squinted at her.
But I killed Bianca before you could balance the scales.
Indeed, simple boy. Why else think you that I gifted you with the most potent powers of fairy to protect you and your companions when we battled Bianca's ultimate progenitors?
I thought you did it because Mab ordered you to.
Tsk. In all of winter, I am second in power only to Mab. Which she has allowed because I have incurred with it proportionate obligation to her. She is my dearest enemy, but even I do not owe Mab so much. I helped you as much as I did, sweet child, because I owed you for collecting a portion of my due justice from Bianca, the Lenanchi said. Her eyes grew wider, wilder. The rest I took from the little whore's masters. Though I admit I hadn't expected the collection to be quite so thorough. Memories flashed in my head. Susan, an obsidian knife. I felt sick. I'll get over it, I told myself. Eventually.
It hadn't been much more than a day from my point of view. I was probably still in shock or trauma or something. If ghosts could get that, I mean. I looked up and realized that Leah was staring at me, at my memories, with undisguised glee. She let out a contented sigh and said,
You do not settle things by half measures, do you, my godson?
I could get mad at her for being callous about calling those memories to my mind, or I could revile her for taking such joy in so much destruction and pain, but there was no point in doing so. My godmother was what she was, a being of violence, deceit, and the thirst for power. She wasn't human. Her attitudes and reactions could not fairly be called inhumane. Besides, I had gotten to know Leah's sovereign, Queen Mab, in a fashion so hideously intimate that I could not possibly describe it. And believe me, if Leah had been the high priestess of murder, bloodlust, scheming, and manipulation, then Mab was the goddess my godmother worshipped. Come to think of it, that was probably an apt description of their relationship. Six of one, half a dozen of another. My godmother wasn't going to change. There was no sense in holding what she was against her, so I just gave her a tired, whimsical smile instead. Saves time, I told her. Do it thoroughly once, and you don't have to fool around with it again later. She dropped back her head and let out a deep-throated laugh. Then she tilted her head and looked at me.
You didn't realize what would happen to mortal kind when you struck down the Red King and his brood, did you?
I saw the opportunity, I said after a moment. If I'd stopped to think about the trouble it would create... I don't know if I'd have done it any differently. They had my girl. Her eyes gleamed.
Spoken as someone worthy to wield power.
Coming from you, I said, that's a little bit unsettling, actually. She kicked both feet, girlishly pleased, and smiled down at me.
How sweet of you to say so.
The best thing about my fairy godmother is that the creepy just keeps on coming. I'll trade you, I said, the rest of the tale for information. She nodded her head in a businesslike fashion.
The tale for questions three?
Done.
Done, done, and done,
she replied. So I told her. Chapter 31 I ran and ran for a good long while. I wasn't on the cross-country team at school, but I often went running with Elaine. It was how we'd hidden sneaking off to make out, and stuff, from Justin. He was a thorough sort of guy, so we made sure to actually do the running, too, in order to make our deception flawless. And the whole time we thought we were getting away with it. As an adult, I could see that our efforts were about as obvious as they could possibly be. Justin had known, I was certain, now. But back then, Elaine and I had been sure that we were masters of deceit. That scheme's trappings were sure as hell turning out to be handy that day. My strides slowed, but turned longer, steadier, machine-like. I was 16. I didn't wind down for almost an hour. When I finally stopped, the terror had faded, if not the heartache, and I found myself in an entirely unexpected position. I didn't know what was coming next. I didn't know what was expected of me. I had to think, all by myself. I ducked off the road and into a large culvert, huddling there while I got my breath back and flailed at the wet paper bag my brain was trapped within. Mostly, I just kept thinking that I should have known. No one in my life had gone an inch out of their way to look out for me once my parents were gone. Justin's generosity, even seasoned with the demands of studying magic, had been too good to be true. I should have known it. And Elaine, she'd just sat there while he'd been doing whatever he was going to do. She hadn't tried to warn me, hadn't tried to stop him. I had never known anyone in my life I had loved as much as Elaine. I should have known. She was too good to be true, too. I wept for a while. I was tired and cold, and my chest ached with the pain of loss. In a single moment, my home had been destroyed. My life had been destroyed. But I shook my head ferociously, wiping my eyes and my nose on the leather sleeves of my jacket, heedless of what it did to them. I was still in danger. I had to think. I had no means of travel, no money, and no idea where to go. Hell's bells. I was lucky I had my shiny new driver's license in my pocket. It was mid-November, and my school letter jacket wasn't going to be enough to keep me warm once it got dark. My stomach made a cavernous noise, and I added starving hunger to my list of problems. I needed shelter. I needed food. I needed to find someplace safe to hide from my mentor until I could figure out how to take him on. And to get all of that, I needed money. And I needed it fast. So, once it got dark, I was 16. Once it got dark, I sort of knocked over a convenience store. For lack of anything better to hide my face, I'd tied my sweaty t-shirt around my head in a sort of makeshift balaclava. I didn't have anything else to wear except my letter jacket, which seemed more or less like a screaming advertisement to make it simple for the cops to figure out my identity. There wasn't much I could do except to rip all the patches off of it and hope for the best. After that, I'd scavenged a paper sack from a trash bin, emptied it, and stuck my right hand in it. Once I had my equipment ready, I looked up at the streetlights glowing outside the quick stop and flicked a quick hex at them. Learning magic is hard, but if you can do even fairly modest spells, you find out that wrecking technology is easy. Anything with electronics built into it is particularly susceptible to a hex. But if you put enough oomph into it, even simpler technology can be shorted out or otherwise made to malfunction. At 16, I wasn't anywhere near the wizard I would be even 5 or 6 years later, but those lights didn't have a prayer. The two streetlights over the parking lot flickered and went black. I hit the lights outside the store next, and two security cameras. I was getting increasingly nervous as I went along, and the last hex accidentally blew out the store's freezers and overhead lights along with the security camera. The only lighting left in the place came from a pinball machine and a couple of aging arcade video games. I swallowed and hit the door, going through in a half-doubled-over crouch so that there wouldn't be any way to compare my height to the marker on the inside frame of the door. I held out my right hand like it was a gun, which it might have been. I had the paper sack I had acquired pulled over it. There was something cold and squishy and greasy on the inside of the bag. Mayonnaise, maybe. I hated mayo. I hustled up to the cashier, a young man with a brown mullet and a Boston T-shirt, pointed the paper sack at him and said, "Empty the drawer!" He blinked reddened, watery eyes at me, then at the paper bag. "Empty the drawer or I'll blow your head off!" I shouted. It probably would have been more intimidating if my voice hadn't cracked in the middle.
Man, the cashier said,
and I finally twigged to the scent of recently burned marijuana. The guy didn't look scared. He looked confused.
"Dude, what is... Did you see the lights just..."
I really hadn't wanted to do this, but I didn't have much of a choice. I made a little bit of a production of turning the gun to point at the liquor bottles behind the counter, gathered up my will, and screamed, "Kabang! Kabang!" My verbal incantations have actually gotten more sophisticated and worldly over the years, not less. I know, right? It shocks me, too. The spell was just basic kinetic energy, and it really didn't hit much harder than a baseball thrown by a high school pitcher. A regular pitcher, not like Robert Redford in The Natural. That wasn't really enough power to threaten anyone's life, but it was noisy, and it was more than enough energy to smash a couple of bottles. They shattered with loud barking sounds and showers of glass and booze.
"Holy crap!"
shouted the cashier. I saw that his name tag read Stan.
"Dude!"
He flinched down, holding his arms up around his head.
"Don't shoot!"
I pointed the paper bag at him and said,
"Give me all the money, Stan."
"Okay, okay," Stan said. "Oh, God, don't kill me."
"Money!" I shouted. He turned to the register and started fumbling at it, stabbing at the keys. As he did, I sensed a movement behind me, an almost subliminal presence. It's the kind of thing you expect to experience while standing in a line, the silent pressure of another living being behind you, temporarily sharing your space. But I wasn't standing in a line, and I whirled in panic and shouted, "Kabang!" again. There was a loud snap of sound as pure force lashed through the air and the glass door to a freezer of ice cream shattered.
"Oh, God!" Stan moaned. "Please don't kill me!"
There was no one behind me. I tried to look in every direction at once and more or less succeeded. There was no one else in the store. And yet the presence was still there, on the back of my neck, closer and more distinct than a moment before. What the hell?
"Run!" said a resonant baritone.
I turned and pointed the paper bag at the pair of video games.
"Run!" said the voice on the Sinistar game. "I live. I am Sinistar."
"Don't move," I said to Stan. "Just put the money in a bag." "Money in a bag, man,"
Stan panted. He was practically sobbing.
"I'm supposed to do whatever you want, right? That's what the owners have told us cashiers, right? I'm supposed to give you the money. No argument, okay?"
"Okay," I said, my eyes flicking nervously around the place. "It's not worth dying for, is it, Stan?"
"Got that right," Stan muttered. "They're only paying me $5 an hour."
He finally managed to open the drawer and started fumbling bills into a plastic bag.
"Okay, dude, just a second."
"Run!" said the Sinistar machine. "Run!"
Again, the insubstantial pressure against the back of my neck increased. I turned in a slow circle, but nothing was there. Nothing I could see, at any rate. But what if there was something there? Something that couldn't be seen? I'd never actually seen something summoned from the netherworld, but Justin had described such beings repeatedly, and I didn't think he'd been lying. Such a beast would make an ideal hunter, just the sort of thing to send out after a mouthy apprentice who refused to wear his straitjacket like a good boy. I took two slow steps toward the video game, staring at its screen. I didn't pay attention to the spaceship or the asteroids or the giant disembodied skull flying around. I didn't care about the flickers of static that washed across the screen as I got closer, something inside its computer reacting to my presence. No. I paid attention to the glass screen and to the reflection of the store that shone dimly upon it. I identified my outline on it, long and thin. I could see the vague outlines of the store as more shadowy shapes, aisles and end caps, the counter and the door, and the thing standing just inside the door. It was huge. I mean, it was taller and broader than the door was. It was more or less humanoid. The proportions were wrong. The shoulders too wide, the arms too long, the legs crooked and too thick. It was covered in fur, or scales, or some scabrous fungal amalgamation of both. And its eyes were empty, angled pits of dim violet light. I felt my hands begin to shake, tremble. Actually, they became absolutely spastic. The paper bag made a steady rattling sound. There was a creature from another world standing behind me. I could feel it, no more than 7 or 8 feet away from me, every bit as real as Stan, to every sense but my sight. It took a real effort to move my head enough to cast a single hurried glance over my shoulder. Nothing. Stan was shoveling various bills into a bag. The store was otherwise empty. The door hadn't opened since I'd come through it. There was a bell on it. It would have rung had it opened. I looked back at the reflection. The thing was 2 feet closer, and it was smiling. It had a head whose shape was all but obscured by growths or lumpy scales or matted fur. But beneath its eyes I could see a mouth, too wide to be real, filled with teeth too sharp and serrated and yellow to belong to anything of this earth. That was a smile from Lewis Carroll's opium-inspired, laudanum-dosed nightmares. My legs felt like they were going to collapse into water at any second. I couldn't catch my breath. I couldn't move. Malice slithered up my spine and danced in spiteful shivers over the back of my neck. I could sense the thing's hostility. Not the mindless anger of a fellow boy I'd needled beyond self-restraint, or Justin's cold, logical rage. This was something different, something vaster, more timeless, and deeper than any ocean. It was a poisonous hate, something so ancient, so vile, that it could almost kill without any other action or being to support it. A hate so old and so virulent that it had curdled and congealed over its surface into a stinking, staggering contempt. This thing wanted to destroy me. It wanted to hurt me. It wanted to enjoy the process. And nothing I said, nothing I did would ever, ever change that. I was something to be eradicated, preferably in some amusing fashion. It had no mercy, it had no fear, and it was old, old beyond my ability to comprehend. It was patient, and if I proved too disappointing to it, I would only break through the veneer of that contempt, and what lay beneath would dissolve me like the deadliest acid. I felt stained simply by feeling its presence. Stained as if it had left some hideous imprint or mark upon me, one that could not be wiped away. And then it was behind me, so close it could almost touch, its outline towering over me, huge and horrible. And it leaned down. A forked tongue slithered out from between its horrible shark chainsaw teeth, and it whispered in a perfectly low, calm British accent, "What you have just sensed is as close as your mind can come to encompassing my name."
How do you do? I tried to talk. I couldn't. I couldn't make the words form in my mouth. I couldn't get enough air to push my voice up out of my throat. Damn it! Damn it! I was more than some terrified child. I was more than some helpless orphan, preparing to endure what someone vastly older and more powerful than me was preparing to inflict. I had touched the very forces of creation. I was a young force of nature. I had seen things no one else could see, done things no one else could do. And in a moment like that, there was only one thing I could ask myself. What would Jack Burton do?
I'm fine, I said in a hoarse, hardly understandable voice. That's a mouthful, and I'm busy. Do you maybe have a nickname?
Its smile widened. Little morsel, among those whom I have disassembled. It purred, its tone wrapping lovingly around the last word of the phrase. I have several times been called by the same phrase.
Oh? What's that?
He, purred the thing, who walks behind. Chapter 32.
He who walks behind,
I said, fighting a losing battle to keep from trembling.
As scary names go, that one kind of isn't. I'd stick with the first one, more evocative.
Be patient, purred the creature's disembodied voice. You will understand it before the end.
Dude? Stan asked quietly. Who are you talking to?
Oh, tell him, the creature said. That should be entertaining.
Shut up, Stan, I said, and get out.
Said Stan. What?
I whirled on him and pointed the paper bag at him, my arms extending through the space where he who walks behind apparently both was and wasn't.
Get the hell out of here!
Stan fell all over himself trying to comply. He literally went to the tile floor twice on his way to the door, his eyes wide, and stumbled out and into the night. I turned back to the reflective surface of the video game's screen, and just as I again found the shape inside it, fire erupted along my spine. I was slammed forward into the video game, and my head hit hard enough to send a spider web of cracks through the machine's glass screen. Pain, sickening and harsh, flooded through my skull, and I staggered. But I didn't fall. Justin Dumorne had been hard on me. It hadn't ever been this bad, this scary, and it had never hurt so much, but then it had never been for real. I grabbed the machine's sides, forced my fingers to hold on, and kept myself from falling.
Run, run, screamed the machine again.
This time the voice was blurred and distorted, disturbingly deep and malicious. I noted blurrily that the cracked and wildly flickering screen had a terrified wizard's blood all over it. The game's computer was apparently failing.
You think that the inebriated little mortal is going to run to fetch the authorities,
purred the creature's voice. I turned my head, looking around, and didn't see anything. But the motion sent fire down my back, and for the first time I felt a trickling there beneath my jacket. I was bleeding.
You think that if they come running in their vehicles with their lights and their symbols that I will flee?
I turned and put my back to the machine. My legs felt wobbly, but I was beginning to fight through the pain. I clenched my teeth and snarled,
Get away from me!
I assure you, came the creature's bodiless voice, that we will not be disturbed. I have made sure of it. But it does demonstrate that you possess a certain talent for performance under pressure, does it not?
You sound like my guidance counselor, I said, and wiped blood from one of my eyes.
I took a breath and stalked forward, wobbling only a little. I grabbed the bag of money Stan had left on the counter.
I guess maybe you are a little scary.
Neither fear nor pain sway you from your objective. Excellent.
This time the thing's voice was coming from the far side of the convenience store.
But there's no knowing the true temper of the blade until it has been tested. Even the strongest-seeming steel may have hidden flaws. This may be interesting.
I paused, frowning, and looked up at my fairy godmother, who still sat at the edge of my grave, listening raptly. Godmother, I've heard it said that ghosts are memories.
Indeed, Leah said, nodding.
Are the memories truth?
Leah arched a rather caustic eyebrow at my words. You ask your first question before finishing the tale?
Her mouth twisted in distaste.
Your storytelling form leaves something to be desired, child.
Yeah, I never did too well in English class. Will you answer the question? Her eyes became very, very green and glittered with a wild, gleeful light.
They are the facts, the events as you experienced them.
I frowned. I never really had a clear recollection of exactly what the thing said to me, I said. I mean, that blow to the head gave me a headache for days.
Ah, yes, Leah said. I remember your pain.
She would. Yeah, anyway, I'm remembering the conversation now, word for word.
Is that real?
Or is it something that guy in black made up to fill in the blanks?
They are your memories, she said. The record, the impression of what you lived. Your brain isn't the only place they are stored. It is, in truth, often a poor facility for such a purpose.
She paused to consider her next words and then spread her hands, palms up, an odd light in her eyes.
It is the nature of the universe that things remain. Nothing ever disappears completely. The very sound of creation still echoes throughout the vast darkness. The universe remembers. You are currently free of the shackles of mortality. Your limited brain no longer impedes access to that record. The only blocks to your memory are those you allow to be.
That's either very zen or very, very crazy, I said. So this memory, this is all the actual event?
Did I not just say as much? She asked crossly.
It would make a ridiculous fiction. Why would I bother listening otherwise? I honestly wasn't sure, but I decided not to push the issue. Ghost Harry, wise Harry.
Now, the Lenanshi said, if you are quite finished holding hostage my imagination, pray continue.
Get away from me!
I snarled, clutching the money.
Sparks spat fitfully from the fried security camera. They were most of the light in the place. Even if the creature had been something solid and physical, it might have hidden in the stretches of shadow between the flickering motes of light. I didn't see it anywhere. So it came as a shock to me when something gripped the back of my neck and effortlessly flung me into an end cap of various donuts and pastries. I went through it and hit the shelf behind. It hurt more than I could have believed. Years later, I would have considered it a minor foothill of pain, but at the time it was a mountain. The sweet smell of sugar and chocolate filled my nose. I figured my backside must be coated in about half an inch of frosting, cream filling, and powdered sugar. The scent made my stomach howl for food, gurgling loudly enough to be heard over the sound of items falling from the shelves here and there. Like I said, 16.
Such a useless scrap of meat contains you, the creature said, its voice unchanged by the violence. It is entirely inconsequential, and yet it molds you. Your existence is a series of contradictions. But here is certainty, mortal child. This time, you cannot run.
The hell I couldn't. Running had always served me fairly well, and I saw no reason to change my policy now. I scrambled to my feet and ran for the back of the store, away from the presumed direction of my attacker. I rounded the far corner of the aisle and pressed my back up against it, panting. Something hard and hot and slimy settled around my neck. a noose made of moist serpent and just as strong. It jerked me up and off my feet, a bruising force that threw me into the air and released me almost instantly. I had an enormous flash of empathy for Jerry, facing the raw power and amused pleasure of a large, invisible Tom.
"You cannot escape what is always behind you," it said.
I landed on my ass, hard, and scrambled toward the other aisle on my hands and knees, only to feel another terrible force strike me, a contemptuous kick in the seat of my pants. It flung me forward into a glass door on a wall of refrigerated cabinets holding racks and racks of cold drinks. I bounced off the door and landed, dazed, staring for a second at the large cracks my head had left in the glass.
"No one will save you." I tried to crawl farther away. I made it only far enough to reach the next cabinet, and then a blow struck me in the ribs and flung me into the next glass door. My shoulder hit it this time and didn't break the glass, but I felt something go pop in my arm, and the whole limb seemed to light up with abrupt awareness of pain. The unseen presence of the creature came closer, its voice lowered to a bare, pleased murmur.
"Child of the stars, I will destroy you this night."
My head was full of pain and fear. I could sense it getting closer again, coming up behind me. Always there, I somehow knew, where I was weakest, most vulnerable. That was where it would always be. I had to move. I had to do something. But the terror felt like lead weights on my wrists and ankles, sapping my strength, making muscles turn to water, thoughts to noise. I tried to run, but the best I could do was a slow, slippery scramble down the aisle of cold drinks.
"Pathetic," said he who walks behind, growing nearer with every word. "Whimpering, mewling thing, useless."
Terror. I couldn't think. I was going to die. I was going to die. And then my mouth said, in a damned passable Pee Wee Herman impersonation,
"I know you are, but what am I?"
He who walks behind stopped in his tracks. There was a flickering heartbeat of uncertainty in that inevitable presence, and the creature said,
"What?"
I said in the same voice, double-tapping my own fear with the character's staccato laugh. A thought came shining through my head. Maybe I can't stop this thing from coming at my back, but I can choose which way I turn it. I struggled to my feet and started down the aisle, spinning with every step, whirling, dervish style. The whole time I heard myself spewing Pee-wee Herman's cartoony laugh, which, in retrospect, was possibly the creepiest thing to hit my ears that night. I hit the door with a hip and an elbow and blew through it, still spinning, out into the parking lot. Once there, I realized that my escape plan did not have a part two. It hadn't been concerned with getting me any farther than the doors of the store. I'd achieved the objective. Now what? The darkened parking lot was a mass of shadows. The nearest lights were 100 yards away, and seemed somehow dimmer, more orange than they should have been. There was a heaviness in the air, and a faint, faint stench of death and rot. Had that been something the creature had done? Had that been what it meant when it said it had made sure of our privacy? Stan was in the parking lot, out between the two islands housing the convenience store's gas pumps. He looked like a man who was trying to run in slow motion. His arms were moving very slowly, his legs bent as if sprinting, but his pace was much slower than a walk, as if he'd been trying to run through a rice paddy filled with peanut butter. He was looking over his shoulder at me, and his face was distorted with terror, a horrible mask that hardly looked human in the shadow-haunted night. I began to run toward him on pure instinct, herd instinct, really, operating on the assumption that there was greater safety in numbers. My feet pounded the parking lot's asphalt at normal speed, and his eyes widened with almost comical slowness and amazement as I ran toward him.
"Is that what you are?" came the creature's voice,
from no direction and from all of them.
One of them? One of the swarm that infests this world?
The origin point of the voice changed, and I suddenly felt hot, stinking breath right on the back of my neck.
I expected better of a pupil of De Morn.
I whirled, throwing my arms up defensively. I had time to see everything in the reflection of the convenience store's broad front windows. He Who Walks Behind emerged from the shadows in front of the terrified Stan. Broad, horrible arms wrapped around him, crushing him as easily as a man picking up a child. Another limb, maybe a tail or some kind of tentacle, covered in the same growth fur scales as the rest of the creature, joined the two arms so that Stan was wrapped at the shoulders, at the bottom of the ribs, and at the hips. And then, with a slow smile and a simple, savage, twisting motion, He Who Walks Behind tore Stan, the convenience store clerk, into three pieces. I'd seen death before. But not like that. Not terrible and swift and bloody. I spun back to Stan in time to see the three pieces fall to the ground. Blood went everywhere. One of his arms waved in frantic windmills, and his mouth opened as if to scream, but nothing came out except a vomiting gurgle and a gout of blood. Wide, terrified eyes stared at mine for a second, and I jerked my gaze away, desperate to avoid seeing Stan's soul as he died. Then he just sort of changed, from a person in hideous pain and fear to an empty pile of meat, parts, soiled cloth. I had never seen death come like that, as a humiliation, a reduction of a unique soul to nothing more than constituent matter. When the creature killed Stan, it didn't simply end his life. It underscored the underlying futility, the ultimate insignificance of that life. It made a man, albeit a fairly unmotivated one, into less than nothing. Something that had been a waste of the resources it had consumed. Something that had never had a choice in its own fate, never had a chance to be anything more. I had involved Stan in this struggle. It hadn't been his fight at all. Granted, I had never intended to hurt the guy, and never would have. Nonetheless, without my decision to stick up the convenience store, he would have still been loitering behind the counter, killing time until his next joint. He had been caught up in violence that he had done nothing to earn or expect, and it had killed him. Something in my head went click. That wasn't right. Stan shouldn't have died like that. No one should. No one, man, beast, or otherwise, should get to decide in a moment of malicious humor that it got to end Stan's life, to take away everything he was and everything he might ever be. Stan hadn't deserved it. He hadn't been looking for it. And that creature, that demon, had murdered him. I felt my jaw begin to ache as it clenched harder and harder. I could feel my rapid pulse beating behind my eyes. There was a terrible pressure inside my head and inside my chest, and with it came a rising wave of anger and something darker and deadlier than anger that came welling up like a great wave from an unlit sea. It wasn't right. No, it wasn't. But the world wasn't a fair place, was it? And I had more reason to know it than most people twice my age. The world wasn't nice, and it wasn't fair. People who didn't deserve it suffered and died every single day. So what? So, somebody ought to do something about it. My right arm and shoulder burned like fire as I felt my right hand slowly form a tight fist. The knuckles popped one by one. I had never done that before. I turned to face the creature's image in the reflection. It was crouched over Stan's corpse, its talons tapping lightly on the dead man's open eyes, its mouth still stretched into that horrible, wide smile. And when it saw the look on my face, its smile widened and its eyes narrowed.
"Ah," it said. Ah, there you are.
I was not a victim. I was not a powerless child. I was a wizard. I was furious, and I was finished running.
This isn't your world,
I whispered.
Not now,
he who walks behind murmured, its smile widening.
But it will be ours again in just a little time.
You won't be around to see it, I said. I had never used my power in anger. I had never consciously tried to harm another being with my magic. But this thing, if anything I had ever seen had it coming, if ever a being was deserving of receiving my violence, it was the blood-stained creature crouching over Stan's mangled body. Everything had been taken away from me in the space of a single afternoon, my home, my family, and now it seemed I was about to lose my life. Well, if that was how it was going to be, if I couldn't run without getting more innocent bystanders killed, then I would make my stand here. And I had no intention of going quietly. I reached into that deep well of anger and began drawing it together into something as hot and violent and destructive as what I was feeling inside.
There's something you should know, I said. I skipped 6th hour today. Spanish. Which I'm not very good at, anyway.
What is that to me?
Asked the creature.
Flick'em bickus. Just doesn't seem appropriate, I replied.
The heat in my right arm and shoulder concentrated into my right hand. The scent of burned hairs crept up to my nose.
And you really don't understand where you're standing, do you?
The creature's reflection looked left and right at the gas pumps on either side of it. I kept my eyes locked on its image in the windows, extended my right hand back toward it, and formed my little fire-lighting spell into something 1,000 times bigger, hotter, and deadlier than anything I'd ever attempted before. I met the thing's eyes in the reflection, reached down to the well of energy and pure will I'd built inside me, extended my hand toward the creature, and screamed,
"Fuego!"
My rage and fear poured out of me. Fire lashed out from my open hand like water from a broken hydrant. It spilled all over he who walks behind and over Stan's body and lit up the darkness with angry, golden light. The creature let out a scream, more surprise and anger than pain, clutching at its eyes with its huge hands. The light changed the reflection in the glass, and I could no longer see what was behind me. I swept the torrent of fire left and right without turning away or changing the direction my back faced. I hoped it would slow he who walks behind long enough for my modified fire-starting spell to do its thing. Gasoline pumps have all kinds of safety mechanisms built into them to reduce the odds of accidentally igniting them. They're pretty good. I mean, how many times have you touched off an explosion while filling your car? But as reliable as they are, those measures are made to stop accidents. And no engineer in the world ever thought about building them to stop angry young wizards. It took a couple of seconds, but then there was a screaming sound. Something metallic strained past the breaking point, and the first tank went up in a bloom of spectacular fire. The explosion flung me back, scorching my skin and burning away the hair on my eyebrows. I landed on my ass again and lay there, stunned, for a few seconds. Sudden weariness, deeper than anything I'd ever known, flooded over me in reaction to the energy I'd expended on my economy-sized ignition spell. And then the second tank went up. Hot wind and pieces of smoking metal showered against the front of the convenience store. I'm glad the first blast knocked me down. If I'd been standing, the metal shrapnel that punched out the entire front wall of windows would have gone through me first. I stared at the flames and saw a shape within it. Or rather, I saw a creature-shaped void where the smoke and fire should have been. A voice emerged from the fire, something huge and terrifying, a voice that belonged to the gods and monsters of myth.
"How dare you!" it roared. "How dare you raise your hand against me!"
Then that knot figure crashed to its knees and fell limply onto its side.
The roaring flame swept in and consumed it. And my first true battle was over. Chapter 33. That was my first fight, I said quietly to my godmother. I'd never used magic to hurt anything before. I rubbed my hand over my head. If I hadn't cut class that day, I don't know, I might never have become what I did.
Is that the lesson you took from the memory? Leah asked, her smile spreading. You were clearly being prepared to be an enforcer.
It seems that way, I hedged, trying to read her expression. But Justin never actually tried to get me to hurt anyone.
Why would he wish you to be armed against him before he was certain of your loyalty? Leah asked.
He would have. It was inevitable.
Probably, I said.
But there's no way we can know, really. It's a long way from breaking boards in practice to breaking bones in life.
Quite. Because convincing a young mortal to believe that it is right and proper to use magic for violence is a delicate process, and one that cannot be rushed.
I grunted and leaned my head back against the wall of my grave.
All the wishing in the world will not change the past, my godson, Leah said. You would like to believe that perhaps Justin had hidden good intentions of some sort, that what happened between you was some kind of misunderstanding. But you understood him perfectly.
Yeah, probably. I'd forgotten how much it hurt, that's all, I said quietly. I'd forgotten how much I loved him, how much I wanted him to be proud of me.
Children are vulnerable, Leah said. They are easily deceived and notoriously subject to such delusions. You are no longer a child, she leaned forward slightly and said, with slight emphasis, I am bound to answer two more questions. Will you ask them now?
Yes, I said. Give me a moment to consider them.
As you wish, Leah said.
I closed my eyes for a moment and tried to clear my thoughts. Asking questions of inhuman entities can be a tricky and dangerous business, with the Fae more than most. You almost never got direct answers from one of the Lords of Faerie, the She. Asking them direct questions, especially questions touching on information relevant to a conflict of some sort, was likely to elicit obscure and maliciously misleading answers. I was on good terms with my godmother, as human-she relationships went, but that was no reason not to cover my bases. So I thought over recent events for a while and looked for the blank spots. But I kept getting distracted by the memories of that night in the convenience store. They chewed at me and refused to be pushed aside, especially the conversation with He Who Walks Behind.
Priorities, I said out loud. This is about priorities. Oh?
Leah asked. I nodded. I could ask you a lot of questions about my past, and you'd answer them.
That is true.
Or I could ask you about what is happening right now in the city. I could find out how I could best help Murphy. Leah nodded. But I was sent back here to find my killer, I said. I'm supposed to be hunting down whoever killed me. And yet I've been doing a whole lot of everything but that.
In point of fact, Leah said, you've been doing little else.
I blinked. She gave me an enigmatic feline smile.
Oh, you bitch, I sighed. You just love doing that to me.
Leah demurely lowered her gaze. She fluttered her eyelashes twice. I scowled at her and folded my arms over my chest. Leah had been involved in my life since I was born, and probably before that. She could tell me any number of things I'd been quietly dying to know since I was old enough to ask questions at all. She was up on all the current events, too. All of the High She are fanatic gatherers of information. And my godmother was no exception. Of course, they tended to guard their knowledge as ferociously as a dragon guards its gold, and they parted with it almost as reluctantly. The She aren't dummies. Information is a great deal more valuable than gold any day of the week. So I circled back to my earlier question.
Where did my priorities lie? What was more important to me? Digging up secrets from the shadowy bits of my past? Getting the information I needed to move on to my future? Or helping my friends and loved ones right now? Yeah, no-brainer. What can you tell me about the corpse taker, her resources, and her goals? I asked. Leah considered the answer for a moment before nodding to herself.
The creature you ask about is motivated purely by self-interest. After the body she possessed was killed by a brash, impulsive, and dangerous young wizard, her spirit remained behind. It took a score of moons for her to gather enough coherence to act, and even then she had precious little power to exert upon the mortal world. She was limited to speaking with the few mortals who can perceive such things. So she found them and began to manipulate them, guiding them together into the group you have already encountered. Her goal was to assemble her followers, spiritual and material, and then to abduct a body of appropriate strength.
Clarification, I interjected. You mean a body with magical capability?
With significant capability, Leah replied, stressing the phrase. When Corpse Taker's spirit still dwelt upon the mortal coil, even bodies with latent talent were hospitable enough for her to exercise her full power. But thanks to you, and like you, my dear godson, she has passed beyond the threshold between life and death. Now she requires a body with a much greater inherent talent in order to use her gifts once she is inside it. I tapped my lips with a fingertip, thinking.
So you're saying Mort is a major talent?
In certain respects, he is more potent than you were, godson. And he is a great deal more practical. He avoided the notice of the White Council almost entirely and hid his abilities from them quite neatly. The Corpse Taker wants him. She doubtless intends to make some use of the city's dead and establish herself as the city's dominant practitioner.
I blinked. Why? I mean, she's just going to attract attention from the council if she does that, and she's still on their wanted dead or alive, but mostly dead list.
Not if she looks like the little ectomancer, Leah countered. She will simply be a concealed talent unveiling itself in a time of dire need.
But why risk it in the first place? Why Chicago?
Leah frowned, golden red brows drawing together.
I do not know. But the Fomor are dangerous folk with whom to make bargains.
I lifted my eyebrows. Considering the source, that was really saying something.
In my judgment, she continued, the only reason Corpse Taker would deal with the Fomor would be to establish her presence here, probably as a loosely attached vassal of their nobility.
I found myself scowling. Well, she isn't going to do it. This is my town. My godmother let out another silver chime laugh.
Is it, even now?
Of course, I said. I rubbed at my jaw. What happens if she gets Morty?
Leah looked momentarily baffled.
She wins?
I waved a hand. No, no. How do I get her back out of him? Her eyelids lowered slightly.
You have already utilized the only method I know.
So I gotta get her before she gets to Morty, I said quietly.
If you wish to save his life, yes.
And from the sound of the conversation with creepy servitor guy, I'd better break up the Corpse Taker Fomor team before it gathers any momentum.
It would seem to be wise, Leah said.
Why the Fomor? I asked. I mean, I barely know who they are. Why are they all over Chicago now? Who are they?
Once they were the enemies of my people, winter and summer alike, she said, lifting her chin as her emerald eyes grew distant. We banished them to the sea. Now they are the exiles of myth and legend, the outcasts of the gods and demons of every land bordering the sea. Defeated giants, fallen gods, dark reflections of beings of light. They are many races and none, joined together beneath the banner of the Fomor in a common cause.
Revenge, I guessed.
Quite. It is a goal best served by gathering power, an activity that has been made attractive by the fall of the Red Court. And I have been more than generous with my answer to your question. You have. I'm grateful, Godmother. She smiled at me. Such a charming child, betimes. Two questions have been answered. Your third? I thought some more.
Somehow I doubted that asking, "Say, who killed me?" would yield any comprehensible results. On the other hand, what the hell? You never know until you try.
"Say," I asked, "who killed me?"
Chapter 34.
The Lenanshi looked down at me, her almond-shaped green eyes distant, pensive.
"Oh, my child," she breathed after a moment, "you ask such dangerous questions."
I cocked my head to one side. "You agreed to answer."
"And I must," she agreed.
"And I must not," I frowned. "That doesn't make any sense."
"Of course, child, you are not she."
She crossed her ankles, frowning, and I saw a distinct spark of irritated rebellion enter her eyes.
"I'm of a mind to tell you and end this charade."
"You must not."
Eternal Silence's voice wasn't quite the same mind-destroying artillery shell it had been the first time the verdigris-encrusted statue had thought spoken to me. But that might have been a function of me being sheltered in what amounted to a foxhole. The force of it blew Leah's long hair straight back, and her head snapped to one side, as sharply as if she'd been slapped on the cheek. A shadow fell across my grave, and I looked up to see the statue looming overhead in broad daylight, which meant
that whatever the thing was, it wasn't a ghost like me.
I'd have been withered and blasted into the scraps of what I was now if I'd ventured out of my grave. The lingering power of the dawn wouldn't destroy me, but it would hurt a lot, and it would cripple and weaken me. Eternal Silence was apparently having no problems with it. Leah turned her head back to the statue, her eyes an expression cold.
"I am perfectly aware of the situation," she spat.
Then she tilted her head to one side and paused, as if listening to a speaker I couldn't hear. She sighed.
"Fear not, ancient thing. I have no intention of depriving either of you."
"What?
What?
Either of who?" It was one of those questions to which I knew damn well that no one would tell me the answer. Crud. Clearly I should have haggled for 7 questions.
"Child," Leah said, "I will tell you an answer that is true, but it is not the answer that you desire."
3 true answers, I shot back immediately. "The bargain was made in good faith." Leah puffed out a little breath and made a very contained and elegant gesture that somehow managed to convey the same meaning as if she had thrown her hands up.
"Will you never cease pushing?"
"Never, ever," I said.
"Impossible, child." "Oh, very well. If it will fill that bottomless well you call curiosity."
She shook her head, glanced again at Eternal Silence, and said,
"The first truth is that you are acquainted with your killer."
I swallowed. The single, truly redeeming factor of the she, winter or summer, is that they can't knowingly speak a lie. They are, in fact, completely incapable of it. That's not the same thing as saying that they can't deceive. They are past masters of deceit, after all. But they can't do it by directly speaking words that aren't true. Which meant that, assuming Leah's information was good, I had just eliminated better than 6 billion possible suspects, and Leah's information was always good. Leah nodded at me, the gesture so slight that I almost thought I imagined it.
"The second truth is that your murder was but one of thousands at the killer's hands."
I took that in as well, trying to look at it from all angles. I knew some people and things who were stone-cold killers, but beings who had killed thousands of mortals were few and far between. Famous snipers in the World Wars hadn't accumulated more than a few hundred kills. Serial killers working for decades hadn't done any better. But supernatural predators, especially the long-lived ones, could add up that kind of count in a particularly active century or two. Oh, and I had done my best to shut down pretty much every one of them I actually knew. The suspect pool was rapidly growing smaller.
The final truth, Leah said.